This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention that everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
And welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast Podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Today, I'm speaking with New Zealand sports journalist Nick Bewley. On the field and off the field, Nick has been covering triumphant wins and crazy upsets since way back when. Growing up near the beautiful shores of Ottawa, he's taken his love of the game and brought it to the masses through his daily updates on News Talk ZB or commentating for local Christchurch legends, the Crusaders. Welcome to the show, Nick. How's things, mate?
Thank you, Jamie. Yeah, no, I'm very well, thank you. You've caught me at a pretty busy time. It's sort of crossover between those codes like rugby and cricket, February here in New Zealand. But, very keen to, well, hopefully you can get something out of this and hopefully the listeners can too. It's been a pretty cool ride so far. I've been lucky enough to have in the world of broadcasting and sports journalism in particular.
Well, I guess a good place to start is obviously Ottawa, which is where you grew up. And while the much-famed Ottawa Walk of Fame was controversial for almost getting your lovely town a whopping huge fine, I don't know if you know much about it, apparently it was from Hollywood, what name do you think is missing from its ranks?
Certainly not mine. I know, well, Sean Johnson should be there. He was the most famous kid that came out of a real college when I was there, went on to do great things on the rugby league field with the Warriors. I'm very far down the list of exports out of Orua, mate. But it was a great place to grow up. Like, I was a bit of a nomad. I was born in Invercargill. My mum then remarried and met a school teacher from Christchurch, and then he got a job in Stanmore Bay, which is a little bit further along from Orua. So when I was about five, moved up there and, yeah, living on the Whangaparoa Peninsula and a bit of a you know, beach on either side, and it was a cool place to start my life, yeah.
In a way, I guess you're almost a northerner by heart, but in terms of birthright, you're a southerner. Is that why you're now in Christchurch? Is it kind of like it was always your spiritual home?
Yeah, it's a funny question I get asked, particularly in this job I have at ZB, where, and being in Canterbury, it's so parochial, right? Like, we're so proud, or the people here are so proud to be, you know, there's black as well as red running through our veins. But, I don't quite know where my allegiance lies. As I say, my sort of mum and dad's extended family are from Southland, got connections to Canterbury, connections now to Orua and that north of Auckland. So, I'm probably lacking a little a little bit of identity. Like, I want to see the Canterbury sports teams these days do well because I'm so, you know, so involved with them from a reporting standpoint. So I guess if push came to shove, I'd probably support the Crusaders and call myself an adopted Cantabrian.
And would you say that the sport bug kind of came from more of your old man or your old lady? What say was kind of like the birth of you kind of getting interested in sport itself? Because I know a lot of people will always say the old man, say dad was watching rugby or dad was watching cricket, but would you say that runs true with yourself as well?
Yeah, just a combination of the two. Like, I probably lived a, you know, not too uncommon New Zealand lifestyle growing up as a young boy. Played a bit of everything. I was down playing rugby in the winter, cricket in the summer. My mum was heavily involved at our local netball club. Herself, she was, when I was in my early days, a school teacher, then went on to be a principal at the local school. So I was just involved in sport early on from the get-go. My dad, who still lives over in Tasmania, I'd go over and every sort of second school holiday throughout about the age of 5 to 17, 18, I'd go over to him, and he was a mad sports, still is a mad sportsman. We'd watch cricket and Aussie rules and whatever else. And that's, I guess, how I sort of got the bug. And then I'm sure, as we'll get into, I sort of got to that stage, sort of mid-teens, where I was like, I don't know if I'm quite good enough at any of these sports that I play to make it a profession. So how do I take all this useless information that's stored up here and put it to some sort of good use? And I guess that's how I started looking at what could be a possibility, and obviously landed on broadcasting.
Do you think there was any like pivotal moment for you during, especially high school, which is usually when you're quite impressionable, you're trying to make that ultimate decision of like, what's going to be my career? What path am I going to go down? Was there any particular pivoting moment that you're like, you heard maybe a commentator or a particular sports journalist that you really enjoyed hearing, and then you're just like, I need to be here. I need to be in this industry. Was there any moment like that for you?
Yeah, I can't think of one exact moment, Jamie, but I was sort of naturally curious, like an early teen to read the paper and listen to like radio sport back in the day is a little unusual. Probably most other of my mates are playing like Call of Duty or out actually playing sport themselves rather than listening and wondering how do the quotes get here? Like how is that reporter or who's written this article, how have they spoke? How have they had access to this athlete or this team? So, I started doing, going through Oro College, a little bit more research, and I was doing media studies and English and the like, and sort of looking at those options. And it was really a bit of luck in terms of timing. You know, we had my final year at high school was 2011, and some of our listeners might know that that's the year New Zealand hosted the Rugby World Cup. So, it was just a very exciting time for sports fans and just New Zealand in general, having an event of that magnitude in our backyard. And I just started to pay a bit more attention as to that reporting and the storylines and the narratives, and I actually set up my own Twitter account when I was in year 13, and started following a bunch of these sports journalists and teams, and just trying to get a bit more information, that sort of immediacy of information. And one thing sort of led to another from there, really. I was sort of tweeting my own sort of hot takes about the Rugby World Cup and following athletes, and a well-known sports broadcaster by the name of Martin Devlin started replying to a couple of things I was saying, and it was quite strange because I'd growing up and heard a lot of Marty on Radio Sport, and he was at Radio Live at the time, which ceases to exist. It was sort of MediaWorks' big competitor, or taking on News Talk ZB in that commercial sort of talkback radio space and sport as well. And he said, look, we've got all hands on the deck for Rugby World Cup. It's going to be a really busy time. Like, why don't you come in and take a look and see what you think? And by that time, I was already starting to think about broadcasting school. There's a course at AUT. And so I just, wanted to just reaffirm my belief at that stage anyway, that's one of what I wanted to do. And so I made the drive from, Orewa to Ponsonby and had a good look for myself. And from there, it was, the rest is history, as you say. I just sort of caught the bug, as Marty alluded to. There was a lot happening because they were trying to cover almost every game, which was scattered around the country. There was quite a lot of things also happening, like my beloved Warriors made the NRL Grand Final over that same period in 2011. The Breakers basketball team went on to win their first ANBL basketball title. So there's quite a little few things to pick up. So that was kind of my first job after that first time going and saying g'day to some people. It was, you know, can you help piece together some audio reports from the field from our reporters covering the World Cup? And can you just keep an eye on, you know, some of the other things happening, of which, you know, on any other circumstance, you know, the Warriors making a grand final would have been lead sports news, but because this little thing called the World Cup was on, was a little sort of minor footnote, if you will. But that kind of kicked it off, and then from there, the following year I was at B School. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely reflecting a lot of the similar sort of sentiments that I've had from a lot of my other guests who have said that basically it's not always about luck. It's about the right time and taking the opportunities. And I feel like you really dug in there, especially from the fact that your first opportunity kind of jumped off from Twitter, which I have noticed is kind of like the back pocket tool of a lot of journalists looking to either do outreach or obviously get in touch with certain people, whether it be like athletes or anyone in between. And Martin Devlin, that's a hell of an introduction to get put into like radio. Was that kind of what saw you leading a career into more radio more than any other form of media?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, there was something about, I used to get told when I played rugby, I was either first five or a halfback, that I just sort of had a bit of the gift of the gab and I was a bit mouthy. So I suppose radio was just a nice little landing spot for me, and probably took the pressure off my mum or stepdad or my grandma in terms of listening to some of my, you know, takes about certain sports games or what have you. So yeah, like there was some sort of attraction about radio. I guess, you know, a lot at that point in time, like, you know, now we're in 2025 and it's a completely different landscape, but and it still is such a vital part in terms of the immediacy of radio, and it can do what you know, a podcast or Spotify or iTunes can't in terms of being that real connection piece to its audience. So yeah, there was an immediate attraction to it. It's not to say like I've done a little bit of TV now and that's been great, and but yeah, radio is certainly where I feel most at home. Yeah.
And you've talked about obviously your other home being Christchurch, and so I guess we're moving and pivoting towards what we were talking about, broadcasting school, which is naturally the next step for you. Obviously, young lad being interested in radio, you've had this introduction during the Rugby World Cup, but I guess a good starting point is if you were to describe your kind of go-to night out in Christchurch during your uni years, during your broadcasting school years, which I'm sure you'll have one particular pathway that you went on when you're talking about a night out, what would it be, especially in Christchurch around 2011, 2012?
Yeah, well, look, as you know, Jamie, like the city is so different now to as it was when I first arrived in February 2012. In fact, just to rewind even before then, during my last year where I'm talking about those experiences from Twitter, obviously, the earthquake happened and there was a bit that, not necessarily hesitancy, but it was sort of like back of my mind, like, gee, do I really want to go and leave beautiful Ottawa to go to Christchurch? Is it still, you know, undergoing the significant recovery? But I've just very much felt from talking to different people within the industry who have been to broadcasting school, they said, yep, it's absolutely 100% worth it. Took their word for it, and so it proved. But to answer your question, yeah, like there wasn't much happening within the four avenues. If it wasn't a house party in Riccarton, it was probably, I'm trying to remember, like the Craik Irish Pub or the Running Bull, maybe. I think I might have ended up there on a Thursday or seven. Yep.
Oh, Thursday night karaoke, right? And the town ball, did you ever grace the town ball? That, like, humongous rugby ball, terrible looking thing right by Madras Street.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's coming all back to me now. Yeah, not too far away. I was at O House, being an out of towner. So right there, nice. Just a stone's throw from broadcasting school in Madras Street. So yeah, ventured a couple of times into that big town ball, bit out of my price range. But no, that was quite a random little spot. And come to think of it, too, like the temporary location for Smash Palace there on the corner of Victoria Street, opposite what's now the Carlton, was quite a cool little spot as well. I have a couple of mulled wines in the winter and enjoy some good company. So yeah, that certainly brings it back.
Oh, solid call, mate. Yeah, that's definitely a wonder there. And Smash Palace still around. Surprise, new location, but still right. And I guess the cool thing would have been for you is that you're coming into this area, you're coming into this space where everyone's coming together to do a very similar thing, but I guess the curious thing would be, were you one of the only sports journalists in broadcasting school at that time, or were there quite a few people that were trying to like get in into that space?
Yeah, my class, so we had a class of 20, and I'd say there'd myself and there are probably about two or three others who showed a real keen interest in sport, one of which ended up being the best man at my wedding some 8 years later. So I guess we just sort of gravitated to each other, this group who had shared similar interests, and certainly went about, you know, the primary reason or the end goal for us was to get into the sports media industry full time. And then the others were sort of, you know, some were very keen on, you know, specifically around like breakfast TV or long form journalism or anything like that. So it was a real like eclectic mix. We had, you know, 17-year-old to a 30-year-old at the time. So it was a really cool group. But yeah, to answer your question, there's about three or four of us. I think of those four, I think we all have had a crack at some stage in working full time in sport, which is really cool. Probably if I reflect back though, Jamie, like I kind of feel like I shouldn't have gone in there so narrow-minded in what's such a competitive job market, right? Like I was all just like sport and nothing but sport. And later on down the track, I kind of found out the hard way that, you know, I think now in Christchurch, I'm probably one of three or four full-time sports broadcast journalists. Second biggest city in New Zealand, you know, there's a fair amount more in Auckland, but I was very much pigeonholing myself, you know, like I can't think of any other, you know, young 18-19-year-old student just going, I'm going to go study and then I'm going to try and get one of about 20 jobs, of which, you know, they're barely ever advertised. So yeah, if you're listening out there and you're like, yeah, I want to be a sports reporter, that's great, but don't be me and go to B school and put all your eggs in that basket. Learn, upskill, do as much as you can, because it doesn't all work out. Well, for me anyway, it was sort of a windy old road to get where I am now.
But do you think that same tenacity is kind of what helped you build your career and maintain your career as well? Because you had this set mind of like, I really want to be in this industry. I really want to be in this particular like vertical. Do you think that's kind of why you've always managed to maintain having a spot?
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
But then sports media.
Yes and no. Like we were alluding to before, I think timing is critical. Timing's everything in so many different landscapes. And, you know, for me, it worked out relatively well. Those contacts I made at Radio Live, you know, if I fast forward to when we're coming into the back end of second year at broadcasting school and everyone's jostling for positioning, as I'm sure you remember, around internships. You know, if it wasn't for what I'd done at Radio Live, like I don't quite know where I would have landed, and being able to intern back with them in Auckland and sport full time in 2014. So yes and no, but at the same time, you make the most of those opportunities. So as soon as you get that foot in the door, it is very, you know, it's vital to make a really strong impression. So yeah, I was tenacious, I was driven. I think though I was stubborn, like I was just talking about, like I think if I had my time over, you know, because I knew I was like, oh, Radio Live, will they'll have my back. I was there for 3 or 4 months before I came to B school. It'll work out, but it couldn't have. It may not have, you know, and then I would have been sitting there scratching around going, gee whiz, what am I actually going to do with this two year degree that I need to finish somewhere with a 6 month internship? So, yeah, it's something that when I look back now and with a little bit of regret, but at the same time, it's worked out okay. Yeah.
Do you feel like an element of that was also the relationship building? Because that's been another commonality with a lot of the guests I've spoken to that have said, like, if you know the right people, if you're able to connect with the right people, they will, like, go a mile for you to make sure that you can either get a job or maintain a job or even, like, yeah, just open up opportunities for you. Do you feel like that was kind of like a similar experience to yourself?
Absolutely. Yeah, like, it is, you know, it can work both ways, but it can be an industry about as much as who you know rather than what you know. So building on those relationships or forging those relationships initially and then building upon them, you know, whether it be through frequent check-ins, like I reflect back on that B-School time, for example, as for those who aren't familiar with Radio Live, which went through various iterations to Magic and the Today FM and now no longer, you know, this is a station that, you know, smell of an oily rag's a bit harsh, but it's going up against ZB, which is this long-standing traditional behemoth in the commercial space, commercial talkback space. So, you know, they didn't have the same resources some of that ZB did. So, like, for example, I think they had one full-time news reporter in Christchurch when I was at broadcasting school, and because I built that relationship, they're like, hey, in and around your studies, can you do some Crusader stuff? You know, can you head along to a training where it suits? And fortunately for me, the broadcasting school tutors thought that was great, because, you know, not only was I studying in real time, I was effectively doing a bit of part-time work in real time. So, and that comes back to those relationships, maintaining those relationships. And it is quite insular in a small industry. So if you make a strong impression here, that news will travel. And conversely, if you screw it up and people then go, oh, like, have you heard of that Nick Bewley guy's second year journalism? And they're like, yeah, he came in like a couple of weeks ago and he just, you know, rocked up and had a poor attitude and, you know, he's hungover, you know, whatever. Then it doesn't work. So, like, you do need to capitalize on all those opportunities. And I always felt like I put my best foot forward to at least, you know, for those people making the decisions, they could see what I was really about. And then from there, not that I've ever been in a team leader space as such, but I always wanted to then pay that back. Like I look back now at other people, other aspiring journalists that have come through these doors and want to get a foothold. And if they come through with the similar attitude, then I'm willing to pay that forward. And if opportunities come, or if they need references or whatever, then I'm happy to be that voice in their corner.
Yeah, because I think sometimes it can be a misconception that the broadcasting industry in particular can be a bit cutthroat. I know for the sake of New Zealand, I'd never found that was the case. Maybe in other countries or other areas where the industry is a bit more, I guess you could say, just a bit more savage, really, because people are more competitive. Do you feel like New Zealand has this kind of nice ability where people are kind of looking out for each other and want to kind of be the person that's supportive? Do you feel like that's the case in New Zealand? And we'll obviously deviate to talking about your time in the UK, but was that your experience in New Zealand, that everyone's kind of helping each other out?
Yeah, and it still is, to be perfectly honest, Jamie. Like, I know probably maybe like in the, I don't want to call it the glory days, but there was probably more like cutthroat, like I'm not out to get you, but I'm out to scoop you. And there's still that competition around like having really good stories and really good interviews, and there's that competitive element between all the, you know, the pieces that make up the New Zealand legacy media. But at the same time too, it is quite a small place, particularly and a small industry within a small place in the grand scheme of things when you talk about the UK and America and what have you. So, you know, there might, in broadcast, like I was saying before, about three or four jobs is, you know, One News, Three, NZME, MediaWorks, RNZ. Like, you're never going to go out of your way to be a prick, because that's like 20% of the workforce, you know? Like, so, like, to be perfectly honest, like, yeah, there's a overarching theme of respect, while still being really good at your job, and that's the way I like to act anyway. Like, there might be others that are a little bit different, but you know, when I think now, like, for example, when we go over to a Crusaders media session and there's about four different outlets there and we're all pretty good mates, you know, like, and if there's ever a situation where it's like, shit, I just looked down and I didn't hit record on my mic or whatever, they're like, don't sweat it. You know, and there'll be a reverse of that at some stage too. So that's what I really like. Maybe that's just the Kiwi humbleness that we all have. But it is a cool industry to work in, that's for sure.
And we were talking about hot takes. That was kind of your establishing part of you jumping onto Twitter, throwing out a couple of hot takes and see what stuck. Now, out of curiosity, because for me, in my experience, I've worked in a sports newsroom before as well, and there's some pretty big characters, I could say. It's kind of like the naughty corner of like any newsroom, and all honesty, you always hear something a bit strange. I'm curious, you obviously did your internship. That was your first like kind of jump into the whole professional space, apart from that 3 or 4 months you did beforehand. What was the wildest hot take you heard during your internship that still sticks with you to this day that you're like, come on, mate, that's so not on?
Oh, that's good. Yeah. The funny thing about sports newsrooms, you're right, we are usually put away in a corner because we're just mouthing off rubbish and, you know, whether it's about sport or something in general that can never go to air, you know, it's it is a bit of a fun, entertaining area of a newsroom. I'm trying to think of something around that time, which, you know, I guess we'd always sit around and kind of compare, you know, greatest of all time lists of All Blacks or whatever, or Black Caps, or, you know, this guy's going to make it, this guy's not. And yeah, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. There's nothing that really jumps out, but I'm probably known for being probably lukewarm or tepid with my takes. And that's probably funny. Like now in the space that I'm at, I guess, you know, fundamentally as a journalist, I have an opinion, but I'm pretty impartial around just presenting the facts and the opinions are incumbent upon the people I interview. When I do fill in on programs and I do commentary, then I can add my flavor to things, but I like to try and keep it relatively straight. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be a total prick then, because I want to try and get an opinion out of you. So obviously, when the Warriors started having their kind of winning streak, a lot of people were jumping on the bandwagon of up the rah. Your thoughts on it, mate? Do you think they're just glory hunters, or are you happy to see more supporters of the Warriors?
Yeah, big time glory hunters. You know, fandom and sport is all about going through the good and the bad. And yeah, well, is it now 2 seasons after that? Like it's great. Like, it was great for the momentum and the groundswell of support that the Warriors had, but yeah, to just be like, oh yeah, I've been through thick and thin, and then you go, oh, like, you know, talk us through 2011 then, like when Shawnee came through, like, man, what a run that was. And they're like, there's place for both, but like, that, you know, don't come at me with the bandwagon. It's not for me. Sport, like I say, sports fandom is all about sticking through. You know, when that's when it really shows, you know, that's what it's all about. Like, it's easy to support a winning team. Look at Auckland FC, the football team at the moment, like 27,000 there. Like, I really hope that there's 27,000 there when they're ninth in 2 or 3 years' time, if that is the case. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
I completely agree with you. I think Auckland FC fans are going to have their days for the first couple of years. They're going to be talking about how, obviously, they've always been on top, and then as soon as they have that losing streak, I'm sure there's going to be something going down. So I completely agree with you. It's the same with the English football club in England as well. There's always going to be glory hunters. So yeah, 100% agree with you. And I think one other thing I'd be interested to jump into is as well is you're starting to make this kind of move 2 years into working as a reporter with MediaWorks. You're kind of thinking, like, what am I going to do now? And then you pivot to the UK. Why? You're sitting at that great point. What made you make that decision to be like, I'm going to jump to the UK now?
Yeah, well, I'm sure my wife's going to listen to this, and I probably need to bring her up a few times because it's quite important to my story. But yeah, when I came down to B school, it was the end of first year, and my now wife was studying second year at Lincoln University. We met and kicked it off straight away. And so I did my second year B school, and we flatted to, I moved in with her, and she had her third year Lincoln, and we just kind of had this sort of awkward, you know, like, oh, like, I just basically said, look, all the internships fundamentally, you know, 90% are in Auckland. I'm going to have to go back. And she ended up getting a job offer at one of the district councils in Canterbury, up the road in Amberley. And we're like, yeah, we'll play it by ear, see how it is. And it, you know, long distance, I don't know if you've had a long distance relationship, but it's pretty brutal. Like, you get, you know, in a way you get the freedoms of, like, I was still 21 years old and had a lot of these other aspiring journos also interning in Auckland, and especially in the sports space, almost all our weekends were Tuesdays and Wednesdays. So we could have that, you know, I could still kind of go out and do my thing with friend groups, but Certainly missed, like, especially after living with my now wife for a year, to then having, you know, seeing her every 3 or 4 weeks and getting red-eyed Jetstar flights and so have you. So, you know, Radio Life signed me on after my internship, and then it was going great, and that was always the friction. It was like her career was going great, my career was going great. Radio Live then merged to become News Hub in the end of 2015, start of 2016. So there was starting to look like some more opportunity there, you know, to further not only the radio side, but moving in with 3 News on the TV side. Online was growing. I was like, as you say, like, why would you leave? But we just couldn't agree. Like, we love each other, but I don't want to move to Amberley or move to Christchurch and concede when there's just nothing. Like, no disrespect to Amberley. Actually, no honestly, I'd never live in Amberley. I'm just going to put that out there right now.
Why, mate? Come on,
that's right. So, but there wasn't the same sort of career trajectory. I was deeply passionate about taking on if I was to leave Auckland. For her, again, wasn't the same sort of opportunity, like to be working at a small council. It really made sense for her to be where she was. And so we went on a holiday. All this time, my mum and my stepdad, after I left Oriwa, they moved over and got into international teaching. They were in Tunisia at the time, went to Brazil a little bit later on, and now they're in Ghana of all places. But we went on a family holiday to South Africa. They came down from Tunisia and we went across. And that just sort of, I was like, man, like, maybe we should travel. My mum and dad, when they were together in the 80s, they'd done the classic sort of London OE. So it always sort of back in my mind. And I said to Kelsey, I said, like, what do you reckon? Like, we can't come to an agreement on where we want to live in New Zealand, at least for now. Why don't we do the 2-year, you know, at least delay that decision and have a bit of fun? And fortunately, I got her to say yes. So, yeah, handed on my resignation at Radio Live or MediaWorks. And, yeah, like, a part of me is just like, man, like, pretty gutting, especially, like I say, like News Hub, and there was a lot of excitement in the building about where it was going to go. And but yeah, deep down I knew it was the right thing for me. And yeah, I can get into the UK, but we had an absolute blast, like, both personally and, you know, initially just in terms of the travel and meeting new people, and London's still my favorite city in the world. And then professionally, it sort of got to a point where the funds dry up and I'm like, shit, I'm going to have to do something other than working all these other random jobs that I was doing just to get by. And and ended up doing some cool stuff in the media space there too. So that's the main reason that we decided, you know, Auckland, Amberley, oh, there's London. So we went to London.
Do you know what's odd, mate? Is you literally have the exact same journey as me. I had the exact same thing. So yeah, had a partner at the time, just come out of broadcasting school, had been working for 2 years, and I was like, you know what, like, I hate, like, well, I didn't hate living in the place I was living in Wanaka, but my partner at the time was working in Auckland, and we had to make the decision, like, who's going to move where? And so London was the option, very similar to you, mate. And I'm curious, what was the weirdest job you had when working in London? Obviously, I feel like everyone's had some sort of weird gig that they've done, like, I've heard people doing staging.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
For like big concerts, other people doing recruitment for random companies. What was like the weirdest gig you ended up taking for a bit of quid?
Yeah, so when we first got there, we got there in mid-April, and then we booked a lot at like a 3-month travel block around Europe from about June onwards with a company called Busabout. They're like a second tier to Kentucky. So it was basically 6 weeks to get Kelsey on board around London because she didn't want to move to Auckland. I'm moving into a way bigger city.
she's a small
town girl. So I'm going from Auckland to London. So I'm like, I got 6 weeks to sell the dream. But all that time, I was like, we should work. We've got our work visas. We don't want to, spend too much of our money that we've saved for this trip. So get into, like, obviously recruitment's massive in London and I've never really been through a recruiter or anything. And he's just like, are you just willing to do like anything? I was like, mate, like anything, like I just need some money to cover this rent that I've got for the next 6 weeks. So I ended up what's called being a lugger. And so that's like set up and pack down of anything from events, you know, primarily events, but like, we need to set up this conference and there's 120 tables over there that need unfolded and unloaded out of a truck. And then we need to set up the sound system and then we need to do this and then do that. And then, you know, but it was actually a really cool way of seeing London. Like, cause you'd get a text and it'd be like SW12. And I'm like, bloody hell, it's SW12 and, you know, your postcode. And then so you'd get, you know, get on this tube line and go out there and a 3-hour job and then have your lunch or whatever and then get another text. Can you do this one? Yes. Bang. You know, and so on and so forth. So it was crazy. I was super fit actually because I wasn't used to any manual labor from being in broadcasting. So I was like carrying all this shit and it was quite funny reflecting on that. So yeah, that would have been the weirdest one. And then when I got back from our travels, there's like a Facebook ad popped up to be a travel agent, which I'd always kind of back myself. I guess the talking as well, from radio and the travel I'd just been on. Worked for a company called Global Work and Travel. And we got this like 6-page script. So you'd have to you'd stumble across like a social media post. Like, do you want to like go have an overseas experience in Canada or Australia? And then if you submit, like, you know, you click on like for more information, and then I'd get a ping at my desks, you know, as soon as you filled out that for more information with your phone number. So it's not quite a cold call, but pretty similar too. And then I'd work through the script, and I guess for me it was about getting someone over to finance for them to, you know, it's like an £1,800 package would help everything from like visas and passport issues to showing you a good time when you first get there, setting you up in accommodation, blah, 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 getting you a job. And they just had to pay like 300 quid up front and I'd get 50 of it. So so I was obviously working bloody hard like to get through to the back end of those scripts. If I sold nothing, it was like £40 for the day. But obviously if I sold two, then it's £140. So yeah. I don't feel like, I hope for those ones that I did sell, they all had a good time because I never knew, that was a interesting experience as well. Yeah.
Do you think the Kiwi phone charm kind of plays to your favor? Because I've done a bit of sales myself and done a lot of stuff at international clients. I feel like the Kiwi accent seems to be the one that people seem to trust the most, or they either do that or they end up laughing at your accent. Did you feel like that was the same experience for you, mate?
Yeah. I think it's a bit of an icebreaker at least. And I'd say, yeah, I'm here. I'm doing it yourself. I'm living what you could be living, you know, in a different way. And they'd sort of resonate with that. And so I think there's something a bit friendly around the Kiwi accent. I think, you know, us and probably Canadians, so like I've never been to Canada and I was selling these packages to Vancouver. So like, just sort of like these, I think we're the sort of two real friendly ones. Some of our it was basically Kiwis and Aussies just in this call center. And sometimes the Aussie sort of brashness and shoulders back was a little bit too much for some of our, you know, ones that would fill our form from Scotland or something like that. It was just a bit too intense. But yeah, like my hit rate would have been like, oh, I don't know, like 2%. Like you get a lot, you get through the first three. Like, oh, I was just interested in the social media posts, nothing about, you know, that's a terrible accent, by the way. But, you know, like you get.
Yeah, I was wondering what the accent was but yeah, we'll go with it.
No, you get hung up on and you get told to get stuffed and, you know, what are you trying to sell me? And I'm like, mate, you filled out the form, you put your phone number. But it was interesting. Yeah.
I feel like you have to go through that sort of period, especially in London. I feel like it has to test you. Otherwise, you haven't really lived there, in my opinion. And in that case as well, you made the pivot to obviously working with ESPN. Do you feel like you got a lot of flack when you first joined, or did you feel like it was a bit more of a natural transition?
Nah, God, I got super lucky with that. Like, I'm trying to remember again, that might have been a Twitter thing. You know, I'm trying to reflect back. So in 2014, when I was at Radio Live, England toured the All Blacks. toured New Zealand to play the All Blacks, and I met a couple of journos just at press conferences and that, and always said, I'd love to like work in London and rah, 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 so follow back, blah, blah, blah. Always networking, always thinking about opportunity. And then I think when I first got to London, I was like just sliding into DMs, just like, da, 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 just, you know, you never know. What's the worst thing that's going to happen? That you don't hear back or it's a no, like, and you're back to exactly where you are. The opposite is something happens. And then, yeah, so it was about October, November. Each year there's usually like what we call here the end of year tour, where the All Blacks go and play in England or Wales and Ireland up there. And this guy that I met at this press conference in 2014, who worked at ESPN, he was like, I'm just looking for some guys who know rugby. You can come into our office in Hammersmith. It is Saturday, Sunday, and you just live blog the end of year tour games. And I was just like, that's good enough for me. Got it over the line with Kelsey. Basically meant 5 days at the travel company, 2 days at ESPN. Not an ideal living situation when you're supposed to be in London just having a good time, but it kind of both dawned on us at that point. She was doing a little bit of, wasn't quite in the council space, but was thinking about getting back into that sort of town planning council space to earn a bit of money, get some international experience. And yes, for me, it felt like the best way in. Again, timing, who knows what would have happened if this didn't happen. Like 4 weeks later, a guy resigns who's on the main stage on our best stuff each day. It was cool, like my first real foray outside of radio but still in the sports content space. So I was very lucky.
Do you think also a difference in culture also played a part in that? Because for a lot of people, rugby is quite, and you can say otherwise, mate, but for most people, from what I've heard, they've said that rugby is quite a posh sport in England, whereas in New Zealand, it's considered a bit more of a working class sport. It's the same in Argentina, where I live. It's a very posh sport, but football is every man's sport. Do you feel like that kind of played to your advantage as well, that there's probably not as many journalists covering rugby in the UK than there probably is, like football journalists, for example, and because your strength was rugby, that kind of played to your kind of area?
Absolutely. Like the two guys they hired, me and the other guy, was from Ireland. He ended up being a groomsman at my wedding, so you can see that I don't have any friends. I just find these people in work environments or study environments, and then they have to tag along. But there'd be certain class in Ireland that's more into like your Gaelic football and your sort of your working class sport, and then similar, rugby's considered a little bit more posh. Probably the same in England. You know, fundamentally, it's a football mad country. Certainly, they still get 80,000 or whatever it is to Twickenham. So there's a lot of following for rugby. But yeah, definitely played to my advantage, because by that point, what was I, 23, 24, covered a fair bit of rugby, Super Rugby. Hadn't done any sort of test matches or anything like that, but you know, having played it and, you know, read about it, written about it, been on air about it, I could just slot in there and knew all the players and just needed to understand the software, really, and then we were away.
Do you think also, because you talked about this and touched about this, about the working holiday visa, how you were on, I'm assuming you're on a freelance contract. Is there something that's a little bit daunting about being on a freelance contract and having to be like, I really need to make sure I'm on the ball, on the game? Or do you feel like that was never something that crossed your mind?
Yeah, one of my favourite sayings in this space is your best ability is availability. So as much as the urge was there to travel and take the old weekend away and, you know, your friend group would be like, oh, you know, because you can. It's like, let's go to Portugal on Saturday. I kind of had to balance that off. I was lucky with the bosses that I had that they understood. You know, I was only there for a fixed amount of time, and in a wider team, there was a couple of times where I was, especially when the summer rolled around, we're like, yeah, we're gonna do this for a month. But in saying that, there isn't as much rugby or there isn't as much football, you know, when the Premier League's not on in June and July. So it kind of worked out okay. Like, it has to, and that trust sort of goes both ways. And I was very upfront, and I said, as much as I'm loving this, like, and one of the main reasons my wife and I came over here was to experience different cultures and go to different places. So because I was upfront about that, I didn't feel like I sprung a huge surprise on them. And they were upfront with me too. If they were like, oh, we're actually going to consider making this a full-time job, which they actually did down towards the end, And I got into a bit of a conversation with them. They said, would you consider applying? We'll have a look at the visa stuff. And I was like, okay, like we'll see. And then as we kind of move forward, like I don't know if this was just my circumstance or other, you know, this is sort of the black and white of it is, but they've basically got to prove that like no one else or no one with an English passport could do what I can do. And like, you can't really do that. Like, yeah, I've got all this unnecessary information about New Zealand rugby, but that's not going to be enough to like deny someone from their home country a job. So as it turned out, it was all sort of perfect timing. We were, you know, we'd done our dash and went home, but yeah, I'm still very grateful for them. Got a lot of the guys I work with on my LinkedIn and their social media, and they're still doing awesome things. So yeah, it's something that I've come back. When I came back to New Zealand, I was in a much better place, and I was far more well-rounded, like having not worked in radio, but still in sports, you know, the sports media industry. Yeah, learned a lot of new skills and being part of such a big company, just seeing how such a global beast operates, as opposed to, yeah, my experience up to that point was radio life, you know.
It's quite funny. You're giving me so many flashbacks because that was exactly the same situation I had, mate. Working holiday visa, couldn't extend, company wanted to extend, and then eventually got to the point that, like, yeah, we have to go through these ridiculous hoops in order to keep you. So, like, we're bowing out at this point. So I can totally understand how you're feeling about that. But like you said, it was almost a perfect pivot to go back to New Zealand. Having that experience, that great experience from ESPN, being able to be, like, the... In a sense, you feel like you were kind of the big fish going back to the little pond again, like you've taken all this great experience and then moving back to little old New Zealand, or do you feel like there was still a lot to learn by coming back here?
Nah, not big fish. Nah, not at all. Like, yeah, like I say, it's cool to say, yeah, I worked at ESPN, but that didn't really get me anywhere. And all the while, like, you know, as I was talking about before, you know, the decision to go to the UK delayed this long decision around where we're going to base ourselves, because we're not going back to a long distance. So as it turned out, we kind of sat down and like had a wee discussion. I was like, yeah, I'd easily move back to Auckland. Kelsey's like, I don't want to go to Auckland. I think a week later she had an offer to go back to her old job in Amberley. And it was kind of like, well, that, you know, she earns more than me, you know, I'm willing to make a concession and we'll just see what happens. Like, Christchurch, second biggest city, we'll figure it out. So moved to Christchurch in the 2017, and from there it was like, okay, well, we've got one person in this couple secure and employment. What am I going to do? So, like, you know, I couldn't just be like, hey, I've worked at ESPN, come employ me. Like, you know, there's only so much jobs going, and that's still probably to this day, like, I laugh about that time when I first got to London in terms of finding work. Like, finding work wasn't an option. It was just it wasn't an issue, rather. It was just the nature of the work, which was quite funny. But, like, when I came back, like, the working environment in sports media in particular hadn't really changed. So by being back in Christchurch and there's, like, three or four jobs, I was like, oh, well, like, I'm going to have to get creative here. Like, you know, from ESPN to what are we going to do here? And again, it was like, get out your Twitter, get out your phone, get LinkedIn out, like, start, you know, because a lot of these things aren't advertised that I've managed to pick up along the way. Like, they're not on Seek or your equivalent, right? Goes back to that point I was making before about who you know. So I was lucky, picked up a couple of little bitsy things that at least ticked a few things over financially, but it was never going to be quite enough. And that's when I had made the real realizations, like, you know, like, I'm just going to have to do anything to make this work. And funnily enough, I got a job at Newstalk ZB in their general news team for the first time ever working in general news. And yeah, it was a good reintroduction back into radio. It wasn't what I wanted to be doing, but the way I saw it, I was like, well, I'm getting my foot back into the New Zealand broadcasting space. I can do that networking within it because I know they have a sports team and all that sort of thing. I can say, look, I've done X, Y, Z, and if their sports reader is unavailable, then I can jump in and do that. So I sort of like, yeah, it made sense. But there was a period there, like 6 weeks, where I was unemployed and getting knockbacks from like 2 degrees and New World. And I was like, far out, maybe I'm not as employable as I think I am. So that was quite a telling reminder that, yeah, you come from ESPN and you think doors are going to open. It's a bit fanciful.
is kind of actually more realistic in describing the media landscape as a whole, which I feel like a lot of people don't understand, is that like when you don't have work, it can be really hard to find another job because there is a lot of time that's in between trying to find that next role. Because a lot of these like media companies, ages before they'll end up employing anyone due to contracts or other things in between. But one curiosity that I thought was really interesting to see was you pivoted and worked for Christchurch City Council for a bit.
Yeah. So if we jump ahead a year, so basically, like I love the people at ZB, and obviously I'm now back at ZB, so that's, you know, funny how things work out. But like general news, just like I admire what these guys do in terms of, you know, this is like sport, by and large, it connects people, but it's immaterial. You know, it's kicking a ball around, trying to get into a net and winning. You know, it's not life or death. Whereas in news, in my 6 months of news, it was like, I'm going to do this story on this issue, or you're going to call up the sister of this guy who's just died, or you're going to do this court case. And it was just, it was heavy. And I never, like I say, right back to broadcasting school, I never got in to this industry for that. So I was just like, far out. Like I feel like I'm doing a disservice because I'm not all in on this like I am in sports. So I was always sort of like ticking over. As it turned out, we went back overseas. We probably one of the only people I know, at least, to not blow all our money in London. I just said to Kelsey, I said, look, there was still, because all that ESPN stuff, like I did make some concessions. I was like, man, I really want to go Eastern Europe. Really want to go like Egypt. Like, what do you reckon? Kelsey's like, oh, I could probably ask my boss at Hauraua District Council, and they gave her 6 weeks unpaid leave or whatever it was. And so we went, I resigned at ZB, went back. But again, like, this is probably the stubbornness of me, the naivety. It's like, well, if I've left the ZB job, which took me 6 weeks to find something, you know, I'm still going to have to find something else. I'm not just going to go and sit on the couch at home. So I think I was in Slovenia or something like that, of all places, and started having a look at the job market again. And yeah, there was like media advisor, Christchurch City Council. And like a lot of journalists do go from, you know, into comms. And I never really thought I'd do that, particularly that early. But at the same time, I was like, there's not many options around. I know enough about local government from listening to my wife all these years. Like, hell, like, we'll have a crack. And as it turned out, my then boss was a former sports reporter, and her son works in the sports media industry. So yeah, it was like I managed to kind of bullshit my way through an interview. Like I was a hard worker. Like I did a good job. But again, like I didn't know all the X's and O's of local government, but I knew enough about relationships. I knew enough about communication, being that conduit between an organization and a journalist. I've been on the other side of that, where I'm ringing a media manager going, hey, my deadline's X, can I get this? So like I knew the landscape of what the job was going to require. So yeah, came back and went into that. It was, again, like such a great learning experience, such a cool environment. You know, 3 years there. And the cool thing about working at a council is like there is a lot of variety of work. So, you know, you might one day be dealing with the media query from a newspaper about a transport project. And then the next, like an issue when I was there at the time, was chlorination in the water. And then the next is around certain recycling. And I was like learning all this stuff. And like it kind of reminded me of sport in a way. Like I'm reporting on rugby today, cricket tomorrow, tennis, and now I've got a motorsport interview. So there was enough, rather than just being doing like one thing all the time, that probably would have grinded me down. So yeah, a little bit. Like it probably just reminded myself that I can be more than a sports journalist, even though that's always what I wanted to do. And then there were, you know, times where I could lean heavily on that sports background. You know, council owned facilities and sports events and things that you know, my experience there they could really lean on. So yeah, it was completely different and outside my comfort zone. But it gave me a greater appreciation for what is done at those sort of big organizations again, and a greater appreciation too for media managers. Now I'm back in on the other side, you know, out of the dark side, if you want to say that. You know, when I do put a request into a media manager, I kind of go into it a little bit more empathetic. You know, probably prior to my time at council, I was like, these guys, you know, and there are bad ones out there. Don't get me wrong. There are bad ones out there that are just, they don't even put the effort in. They're blocking your request for the sake of being difficult, or that they don't want to help you. But by and large, there's a lot of really good media managers that just then they have hurdles along the way in terms of giving back information. The cool thing about working at a council, or I don't know if cool's the right description, but it has to be an open book. It's the ratepayers' money. Like, it's all under the Local Government Official Information and Meetings Act. So, you know, we can sort of massage some of our messaging, but it's all like there in terms of the dollar trail. So yeah, it kind of had to be pretty open and transparent. And yeah, like I say, learnt a lot, had some big experiences. Like, we touched on the earthquake right at the beginning, but I was there 6 months in and we had the tragic terror attack at the mosque. And from a council standpoint, obviously we've got a mayor, but we own all the council land, is all the cemeteries in the city. So it was like an incredibly emotionally draining process, but they needed someone to manage international media at one of our cemeteries where most of the deceased from that atrocious act are buried. And that was incredibly challenging, with media at different demands, and yeah, different families who, you know, some would say, yes, Al Jazeera, you can come and film this. And then the next family would be like, nah, no media, or just this media, or just that. And it was just like, you know, I was so full on. This is a guy, like I say, coming from working in a space where things are largely immaterial. It's just win, loss. Someone might, you know, get dropped or whatever, but this is the real stuff. So that was quite eye-opening. And yeah, just I reflect back on that time and like I didn't see myself ever doing something like that, but it has helped shape me and realize, you know, how lucky I am to work in the work that I am.
Did it also kind of make you feel like you've earned your stripes, like you've been through the ring? Because you kind of have, mate. Like, you pivoted to doing general news, and then obviously, like you said, you had to deal with like what is probably one of the worst tragedies to happen in Christchurch, and you just had to take it on the chin and kind of deal with it. Do you feel like that makes you more appreciative of your time now in sports journalism because you've gone through these different pivots and like gone through these obstacles?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I'm so grateful to be where I am now, where like these doors are opening and I'm being supported by, you know, working with great people and being supported by, you know, great bosses. And yeah, like it's quite surreal now, like in a roundabout way, that I'm where I always wanted to be. But like that time at the council really, really helped shape like who I am and as a person as much as a journalist. So yeah, I'm grateful that was a step, because if I was just comfortable along the whole way, mate, like if I went out of B school and like I did, went back to Radio Live and just stayed there, like I probably wouldn't appreciate it. And there've been times along the way too. Like, I remember back then, I'm like, this is just, you know, it's all falling into place. I'm young and covering sport, and like I did a Cricket World Cup when I was like 21, and it's like, this is all going to just be, you know, rainbows and puppies. And it just, you know, like, I made decisions along the way that you know, who knows, it could have been that way. Like, I chose to go to London and had a great time. But yeah, it does make you appreciate, you know, because I know there'd be a lot of people out there who would love doing what I get to do for a living.
You made a really interesting pivot then after that, because you moved into, and what my opinion, I feel, is probably the hardest thing in sports journalism, is being a play-by-play commentator. Completely different kettle of fish. How did you mentally prepare yourself for your first couple of games, and what was your kind of preparation before that?
Yeah, I actually had a listen back to a couple of my first commentaries a wee while ago. I was going through some old files, actually trying to get the New Zealand Radio and Podcast Awards come up, and we're all encouraged to put together a package. And my 2022 folder was there, and I was just like, "Oh, I have a quick look," and I was like, "Oh man," I thought I knew it all, and as you say, like the nuance of radio commentary in particular, I don't think people quite appreciate. Like, you sit back and you watch a game on Sky or watch a game on TV and you can see it, right? Like, it's all there. So it's just about complementing what you can see. There's a graphic there with the score. There's a graphic there with the time. You can see who's got the ball. You can see where the ball's going, all this sort of stuff. Radio, there's nothing, zero. So it's just the ambience. We also get the connection of the referee's mic, and that's about it, you know. And until I start talking. So you think, if we put it in the perspective of rugby, which is what I'm now entering my fourth season commentating. So it's about who has the ball, where they are on the field, which way they're going. They're going short side left. Are they going open side right? You know, who has the ball now and who's making the tackle? Which way do they then go after that ruck? And then reminding, like, it's constantly built into me now, but it's taken a long time, every couple of minutes there's probably a bunch of different people jumping in and out of the car and turning the game on. So it's like, okay, the score is 10-7 to the Crusaders, 22 minutes gone. If you're just joining us here, Gold Sport, iHeartRadio, Will Jordan scored the first try, blah, blah, blah. You know, and that now becomes formulaic. But when I first started, it's like, oh, well, I've watched all this sport in my life, so I can just say who has the ball. And like I'd make these not outlandish statements, but they are really on radio. Like, oh, what a move that was! Like, what does that mean in radio? Like, I haven't described anything. Like, you can say that in TV. Like, oh, how about that hit? But you need to be like, you know, he's picked him up, copybook. He's got the shoulder, his right shoulder, and right under the ball, you know, and the ball, and tipped him and put him in a, you know, safe position. Whatever. But like, I describe it almost as verbal diarrhea. You just have to keep describing and describing, because like now that I listen to, because I listen to all my other great commentators I work with if I'm in and out of the car, and if they're not doing the same, then they all are. We've got a fantastic stable of commentators, but it really irks me. Like if I'm just driving down to get Friday night's fish and chips and there's 10 minutes to go in a game and I haven't heard the score for that entire duration, like that's a fundamental part of a radio commentary, right? So, but like early on, I was nervous, but I had watched a lot. I thought I knew a lot, and then like I did a Crusaders game. As it turned out, it's 2022. We had like another COVID sort of weird cycle, and they sent all the Super Rugby, New Zealand Super Rugby teams to Dunedin. So my first game was actually off TV. These days, all my games that I do, the home games, are at stadium. So you have to just rely on the screen, on the vision that's provided, which is a bit more of a challenge. And I thought I did okay, because I was just like, oh yeah, what a great move that is, and rah rah, and you know, because I can see on the monitor too, like I can see the score. I'm not reminding people of the time. I'm not reminding people that, you know, like 8 minutes ago a guy got yellow carded, but I need to say that about another 4 or 5, 6 times just so people remember, like, gee, the Crusaders are doing well here with 14 men on the field or whatever. So a huge learning curve. But doing it this way around has set me up to a couple of other doors that have now opened, and I do TV commentary and basketball and a bit of commentary for some streams with track and field athletics. And I'm probably speaking like a third of the amount, and I'm just letting the pictures tell the story. And I'm it's like being the best support actor rather than you kind of have to be the best actor in radio. So, it's been cool doing it that way around, and learning all the nuance of radio commentary and now being in the space where I won't get it right all the time, but like, I feel like nailing those fundamentals now, I can sort of feel like most of the time you could close your eyes, and if you just listened, you could at least sort of see what's happening on a field.
Well, the classic phrasing we always heard at broadcasting school, and I always make reference to this, is theatre of the mind. If you're going on that standpoint, yeah, you're doing exactly that. You're creating this picture of what is happening. And what would you say is probably one of the most memorable moments for you commentating? Because there's always those highlight reels you see on YouTube of famous rugby commentators or football commentators who have called a fantastic moment and have just this amazing one-liner quote. What would you say has probably been the most significant moment for you during a match that you've commentated, that you've pulled out this wonder of a line and you're like, where the hell did that come from?
Oh, mate, to be honest, I don't think I'm quite there yet. You know, I'm so concentrating on everything that's happening. Those little magic moments probably haven't quite transpired. The one probably exception is... we were lucky enough, NZME, to have the rights to the Paris Olympics last year. And so started to, was lucky enough to go up to our team. Didn't go to Paris, that'd have been great. But no, we did it all out of a studio in Auckland. Had like 5 or 6 different monitors, 5 or 6 different commentators working at one time. It was allocated triathlon. Ended up doing a bit of the golf towards the end because everyone else was a bit busy. No one had been assigned the golf. and probably the most random one of the lot that I arguably don't really know a great deal about, but just happened to be, again, timing, right place, right time, or available. Your best ability is availability. Was commentating Finn Butcher, who is from Centro Otago. He competes in the kayak cross, and he came from relative obscurity, or no one really knew much about him, to being a gold medalist. And my colleagues wind me up because, you know, I was so excited, and I think I, you know, yelled out like, "Finn Butcher is," and I couldn't quite see because, again, we're like on the monitor, the vision was skewed, so I was like waiting, like, surely he's won an Olympic champion, like, you know, and because his surname's Butcher, I was just like, carve his name into New Zealand sports history, you know, and like just, like I was, I, but I was, there was just.
You pulled that.
I just pulled that out of nowhere, and like I just had something iconic had to be, because outside of the TV commentary, which I think was a world feed, like I think the only New Zealander to commentate that moment live, and there's a real feeling of responsibility that, you know, and since, like, when we get Finn Butcher on one of our News Talk ZB shows, they'll like play that clip back, and so you know that that's just going to sit in our archives forever, you know, so you want to make sure, yeah, well, first and foremost, you get it right, you say who's won the gold, but yeah, to try and wrap some great words around it, like, and I started to pick out, like, it was such an amazing Olympics, like, we won 20 medals, New Zealand had 10 golds, and like, because I was working with such incredible pros, you're seeing how they're all doing their preparation, and this is my first Olympics, so I was like, wow, like, okay, I really need to like think this through if I get a real opportunity to have a moment. You know, like I think of Elliot Smith, who went through broadcasting school, one of our commentators for rugby. He did the Black Ferns Sevens, and they went back to back, but even he just said back to black, and it was just like, yeah, I was like, lovely. Like, so you just felt like in a room of creativity and like absolute pros. And yes, I got another gold medal later in the games with Lydia Ko, now Dame Lydia Ko, in the women's golf. And I think I said Golden Glove for Lydia Ko was my line, and pretty happy with that. Yeah, I think I did okay.
And did Finn or Lydia ever hit you up and say, what a wonderful job you did, mate?
No, to be perfectly honest, like, I've never got into this industry to be someone. If you want that, then that's cool. For me, it's an absolute byproduct of the privilege of being in the work I am, that if, you know, people are like, oh, wow, like, that's amazing, you know, you get to commentate on this, like, that's great. Like, I have idols within the industry as well, like Grant Nisbets, who's done 300, you know, All Blacks games and the like, but it's by virtue of doing what I do. Like, I don't want to be a poster boy or anything for it. So I've always, especially because like my commentary work is an extension of my journalism, that and relationships are important, but I'm not there to be a friend of an athlete either. Like, you need, in my view, and that's the way I did my study at broadcasting school and the way I came through the ranks at Radio Live, there's a respect, there's a trust, but it is very difficult to then be critical of someone if you get too friendly with them, and that's how I've sort of been taught. So I didn't seek that, and to be fair, it never came. You know, like when they're sharing their Instagram reels and that, it's all of the TV feeds and that, and that's fine by me.
You were covering a lot of different events, mate. You were saying before, obviously rugby and cricket, that was your main thing. Do you feel journalists now, particularly sports journalists now, need to be able to wear a lot more different hats? Like, you were talking before about the fact that you covered Auckland FC's game and Wellington Phoenix, among others. Do you feel like you have to be able to pivot into those different areas to be able to kind of stay in the industry?
There's definitely room to be a specialist in sports media, but particularly in radio, you have to be at least adequate or competent as an all-rounder. You know, I guess those Olympic and Commonwealth Games sports are a little bit an exception to the rule. You know, since Finn Butcher's won his Olympic gold, I don't think I've done any other big stories or haven't commentated on them again. But yeah, in New Zealand, rugby, cricket, netball, football to a degree, basketball, motorsport. Like, yeah, you have to at least have an understanding of how those sports work. And certainly if you're more upskilled or more knowledgeable at all of those, then it's going to help through opportunity. Like I was saying earlier, like, I cover a little bit of basketball here at ZB, but it's in terms of our listenership and what our audience wants. It's not something I cover all the time, but then because I've passionate about basketball, then it's opened up another door in the commentary space. So, there's like the more you know, the better positioned you're going to be in terms of opportunity. Like, if you were coming into the industry now, particularly in sports media, it would be similar in general news. If you're just like I know enough, but I don't know a great deal about a certain political party or whatever, or like, yeah, like, oh, I love my rugby, but I don't follow cricket. I tell you what, one of the first things will be like, you're going to have to get up to date with what's happening in cricket. Like, there's some where it's just a non-negotiable, really. So I'm fortunate in my line of work. Like, I feed into a wider team in Christchurch, but I have the autonomy to decide what I cover and what goes in my local bulletins that I can cover a real range of sport happening, you know, locally as well as nationally.
You also talked about impartiality. Is that sometimes hard when obviously you are a fan of sports, you're a fan of certain teams? Do you feel like sometimes it's hard to remove yourself from that situation, or do you feel like your enthusiasm is always going to show?
I think the impartiality side particularly comes in the journalism space as opposed to commentary. Like I was saying, you can kind of lean into it a little bit more about, certainly around that energy and enthusiasm. Like, I'm, as a Crusaders commentator, the home commentator, I try not to sound like a cheerleader for the Crusaders, but as we were touching on earlier, like, gun to my head, who's your Super Rugby team? I'd probably say the Crusaders. You don't want to sort of step over that line too much. And saying that, though, like, our Olympic coverage was just going out to a New Zealand audience, so we weren't beating down. Like, we weren't cheering when some of the golfers that Lydia was up against put it in the water. But there was a bit more of a, like, a New Zealand feel to it, and celebrating our athlete's success. So yeah, there is that sort of that fine line around it, particularly in the sort of more content and commentary space. But I always like to be, you know, not come across as a fan. And it was hard early on, because I think back to those times, like, when I would go to those Crusaders media sessions while I was still at broadcasting school. Like, their team had, like, Richie McCaw and Dan Carter, and, like, these are guys that 2-3 years ago I'm sitting at home with my parents and, like, they're God, you know. So, like, initially it's like, whoa, but now it's work, you know. Like, there's very sort of seldom, particularly in the New Zealand space, because I do it a lot, that I'm like, oh, it's Will Jordan, like, you know. But, like, yeah, it would have to take something pretty significant now to, like, yeah, like, if you want to be that person who gets a selfie or whatever, that's fine. You probably, like, the journo packing it around are probably going to be like, oh God. Like, I try to keep my fandom. That's why I like following the Warriors. I mean, I think I'm going to follow the Warriors until I die, but I don't really cover them because I'm down in Christchurch. So I can just sort of follow from a distance and be a bit partial to loving that team, and not have to worry about
luxury being removed.
Yeah, not have to worry about going to a media session the next week and coming across like a cheerleader.
And my final question, Nick, because we started at this point, and I feel like we need to end at this point. You talked about how you were playing sport in the early days. That's kind of what got you interested in sport. And then eventually you moved out to obviously looking at a bit more media-sized English and everything else. And you ended up lacing your boots back up in 2024. First off, how did it feel? And do you feel like there's a potential return for Nick to go back on the field, mate?
No. No, I'm not even the athlete in my house, let alone any athletic aspirations. I do enjoy getting back out there. Played a little bit of – they've started kicking this under 85-kilogram rugby competition here locally in Christchurch. I might give that another crack. I've played a bit of Aussie rules in the last 2 or 3 years. Which has been really cool and something different and something, again, that I don't cover in the workspace. So that's been really enjoyable. But I'm far more comfortable here behind a mic covering sport than I am crossing that white line and trying to be a hero. But yeah, who knows? Who knows? If my knees can hold up, then you'll probably see me on a council field somewhere doing something down the line. But very, very happy. Very happy doing the broadcasting, that's for sure.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at beyondbroadcastpod or via email at beyondbroadcastpod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.